and as they glued themselves to the neck of my mount, afforded me a wonderful empathic relief, which a dipterist might not appreciate. Anyway, on my butterfly hunts, I always preferred hiking to any other form of locomotion, except naturally a flying seat gliding leisurely over the plant mats and rocks of an unexplored mountain, or hovering just above the flowery roof of a rainforest. For when you walk, especially in a region you have studied well, there is an exquisite pleasure in departing from one's itinerary to visit here and there by the wayside this glade, that glen, this or that combination of soil and flora, to drop in, as it were, on a familiar butterfly in his particular habitat, in order to see if he has emerged, and if so, how he is doing. There came a July day, around 1910, I suppose, when I felt the urge to explore the vast marshland beyond the Oradesh. After skirting the river for 3 or 4 miles, I found a rickety footbridge. While crossing over, I could see the huts of a hamlet on my left, apple trees, rows of tawny pine logs lying on a green bank, and the bright patches made on the turf by the scattered clothes of peasant girls, who, stark naked in shallow water, romped and yelled, heeding me as little as if I were the discarnate carrier of my present reminiscences. On the other side of the river, a dense crowd of small, bright blue male butterflies that had been tippling on the rich, trampled mud and cow dung through which I trudged rose all together into the spangled air and settled again as soon as I had passed. After making my way through some pine groves and alder scrub, I came to the bog. No sooner had my ear caught the hum of diptera around me, the guttural cry of a snipe overhead, the gulping sound of the morass under my foot, then I knew I would find here quite special Arctic butterflies, whose pictures, or better still, non-illustrated descriptions I had worshipped for several reasons. And the next moment I was among them. Over the small shrubs of bog bilberry with fruit of a dim, dreamy blue, over the brown eye of stagnant water, over moss and mire, over the flower spikes of the fragrant bog orchid, the Nochnaya Fialka of Russian poets, a dusky little fritillary bearing the name of a Norse goddess passed in low, skimming flight. Pretty Cordigera, a gem-like moth, buzzed all over its eulogenous food plant. I pursued rose-margined sulfurs, gray-marbled satyrs. Unmindful of the mosquitoes that furred my forearms, I stooped with a grunt of delight to snuff out the life of some silver-studded lepidopteron throbbing in the folds of my net. Through the smells of the bog, I caught the subtle perfume of butterfly wings on my fingers, a perfume which varies with the species, vanilla or lemon or musk, or a musty, sweetish odor difficult to define. Still unsated, I pressed forward. At last I saw I had come to the end of the marsh. The rising ground beyond was a paradise of lupines, columbines, and penstemons. Mariposa lilies bloomed under ponderosa pines. In the distance, fleeting cloud shadows dappled the dull green of slopes above timberline and the gray and white of Long's Peak. I confess I do not believe in time. I like to fold my magic carpet after use in such a way as to superimpose one part of the pattern upon another. Let visitors trip, and the highest enjoyment of timelessness in a landscape selected at random is when I stand among rare butterflies and their food plants. This is ecstasy. And behind the ecstasy is something else which is hard to explain. It is like a momentary vacuum into which rushes all that I love. A sense of oneness with sun and stone. A thrill of gratitude to whom it may concern, to the contrapuntal genius of human fate, or to tender ghosts humoring a lucky mortal. Chapter 7 1 In the early years of this century, a travel agency on Nevsky Avenue displayed a 3-foot-long model of an oak-brown international sleeping car. In delicate verisimilitude, it completely outranked the painted tin of my clockwork trains. Unfortunately, it was not for sale. One could make out the blue upholstery inside, the embossed leather lining of the compartment walls, their polished panels, inset mirrors, tulip-shaped reading lamps, and other maddening details. Spacious windows alternated with narrower ones, single or geminate, and some of these were of frosted glass. In a few of the compartments, the beds had been made. The then great and glamorous Nordexpress, it was never the same after World War I, when its elegant brown became a nouveau riche blue, consisting solely of such international cars, and running but twice a week, connected St. Petersburg with Paris. I would have said directly with Paris, had passengers not been obliged to change from one train to a superficially similar one at the Russo-German frontier, Verzhbolovo-Aidskunen, where the ample and lazy Russian 60.5-inch gauge was replaced by the 56.5-inch standard of Europe, and coal succeeded birch logs. In the far end of my mind, I can unravel, I think, at least 5 such journeys to Paris, with the Riviera or Biarritz as their ultimate destination. In 1909, the year I now single out, our party consisted of 11 people and 1 dachshund. Wearing gloves and a traveling cap, my father sat reading a book in the compartment he shared with our tutor. My brother and I were separated from them by a washroom. My mother and her maid Natasha occupied a compartment adjacent to ours. Next came my 2 small sisters, their English governess, Miss Lavington, and a Russian nurse. The odd one of our party, my father's valet, Osip, whom a decade later the pedantic Bolsheviks were to shoot because he appropriated our bicycles instead of turning them over to the nation, had a stranger for companion. Historically and artistically, the year had started with a political cartoon in Punch, Goddess England bending over Goddess Italy, on whose head one of Messina's bricks has landed, probably the worst picture any earthquake has ever inspired. In April of that year, Perry had reached the North Pole. In May, Shalyapin had sung in Paris. In June, bothered by rumors of new and better Zeppelins, the United States War Department had told reporters of plans for an aerial navy. In July, Blériot had flown from Calais to Dover, with a little additional loop when he lost his bearings. It was late in August now. The firs and marshes of northwestern Russia sped by, and on the following day gave way to German pine woods and heather. At a collapsible table, my mother and I played a card game called Durachki. Although it was still broad daylight, our cards, a glass, and on a different plane, the locks of a suitcase were reflected in the window. Through forest and field, and in sudden ravines, and among scuttling cottages, those discarnate gamblers kept steadily playing on for steadily sparkling stakes. It was a long, very long game. On this gray winter morning, in the looking glass of my bright hotel room, I see shining the same, the very same locks of that now 70-year-old valise, a highish, heavyish, nécessaire de voyage of pigskin with HN elaborately interwoven in thick silver under a similar coronet, which had been bought in 1897 for my mother's wedding trip to Florence. In 1917, it transported from St. Petersburg to the Crimea, and then to London, a handful of jewels. Around 1930, it lost to a pawnbroker its expensive receptacles of crystal and silver, leaving empty the cunningly contrived leathern holders on the inside of the lid. But that loss has been amply recouped during the 30 years it then traveled with me, from Prague to Paris, from Saint-Nazaire to New York, and through the mirrors of more than 200 motel rooms and rented houses in 46 states. The fact that of our Russian heritage, the hardiest survivor proved to be a traveling bag is both logical and emblematic. Не будет ли ты ведустал? Haven't you had enough? Aren't you tired? My mother would ask, and then would be lost in thought as she slowly shuffled the cards. The door of the compartment was open, and I could see the corridor window, where the wires, 6 thin black wires, were doing their best to slant up, to ascend skywards, despite the lightning blows dealt them by one telegraph pole after another. But just as all 6, in a triumphant swoop of pathetic elation, were about to reach the top of the window, a particularly vicious blow would bring them down, as low as they had ever been, and they would have to start all over again. When on such journeys as these the train changed its pace to a dignified amble, and all but grazed house fronts and shop signs as we passed through some big German town, I used to feel a twofold excitement, which terminal stations could not provide. I saw a city with its toy-like trams, linden trees, and brick walls enter the compartment, hobnob with the mirrors, and fill to the brim the windows on the corridor side. This informal contact between train and city was one part of the thrill. The other was putting myself in the place of some passerby who I imagined was moved as I would be moved myself to see the long, romantic Auburn cars with their intervestibular connecting curtains as black as bat wings and their metal lettering copper bright in the low sun unhurriedly negotiate an iron bridge across an everyday thoroughfare and then turn, with all windows suddenly ablaze, around the last block of houses. There were drawbacks to these optical amalgamations. The wide-windowed dining car, a vista of chased bottles of mineral water, mitre-folded napkins, and dummy chocolate bars, whose wrappers, Cahier, Kohler, and so forth, enclosed nothing but wood, would be perceived at first as a cool haven beyond a consecution of reeling blue corridors, but as the meal progressed toward its fatal last course, and more dreadfully one equilibrist with a full tray would back against our table to let another equilibrist pass with another full tray, I would keep catching the car in the act of being recklessly sheathed, lurching waiters and all, in the landscape, while the landscape itself went through a complex system of motion, the daytime moon stubbornly keeping abreast of one's plate, the distant meadows opening fanwise, the near trees sweeping up on invisible swings toward the track, a parallel rail line all at once committing suicide by anastomosis, a bank of nictitating grass rising, 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 until the little witness of mixed velocities was made to disgorge his portion of omelette aux confitures de fraises. It was at night, however, that the Compagnie Internationale des Wagons-Lits et des Grands Express Européens lived up to the magic of its name. From my bed under my brother's bunk, was he asleep? Was he there at all? In the semi-darkness of our compartment, I watched things, and parts of things, and shadows, and sections of shadows cautiously moving about and getting nowhere. The woodwork gently creaked and crackled. Near the door that led to the toilet, a dim garment on a peg, and higher up, the tassel of the blue bivalved nightlight swung rhythmically. It was hard to correlate those halting approaches, that hooded stealth, with the headlong rush of the outside night, which I knew was rushing by, spark-streaked, illegible. I would put myself to sleep by the simple act of identifying myself with the engine driver. A sense of drowsy well-being invaded my veins as soon as I had everything nicely arranged. The carefree passengers in their rooms enjoying the ride I was giving them, smoking, exchanging knowing smiles, nodding, dozing. The waiters and cooks and train guards, whom I had to place somewhere, carousing in the diner. And myself, goggled and begrimed, peering out of the engine cab at the tapering track, at the ruby or emerald point in the black distance. And then, in my sleep, I would see something totally different. A glass marble rolling under a grand piano, or a toy engine lying on its side with its wheels still working gamely. A change in the speed of the train sometimes interrupted the current of my sleep. Slow lights were stalking by. Each, in passing, investigated the same chink, and then a luminous compass measured the shadows. Presently the train stopped with a long-drawn Westinghousian sigh. Something, my brother's spectacles, as it proved next day, fell from above. It was marvelously exciting to move to the foot of one's bed, with part of the bedclothes following, in order to undo cautiously the catch of the window shade, which could be made to slide only halfway up, impeded as it was by the edge of the upper berth. Like moons around Jupiter, pale moths revolved about a lone lamp. A dismembered newspaper stirred on a bench. Somewhere on the train one could hear muffled voices, somebody's comfortable cough. There was nothing particularly interesting in the portion of station platform before me, and still I could not tear myself away from it until it departed of its own accord. Next morning, wet fields with misshapen willows along the radius of a ditch or a row of poplars afar, traversed by a horizontal band of milky white mist, told one that the train was spinning through Belgium. It reached Paris at 4 p.m., and even if the stay was only an overnight one, I had always time to purchase something. Say, a little brass Tour Eiffel, rather roughly coated with silver paint, before we boarded at noon on the following day the Sud Express, which on its way to Madrid dropped us around 10 p.m. at the La Negresse station of Biarritz, a few miles from the Spanish frontier. 2. Biarritz still retained its quiddity in those days. Dusty blackberry bushes and weedy terrain à vendre bordered the road that led to our villa. The Carlton was still being built. Some 36 years had to elapse before Brigadier General Samuel McCroskey would occupy the royal suite of the Hôtel du Palais, which stands on the site of a former palace, where in the 60s, that incredibly agile medium, Daniel Hume, is said to have been caught stroking with his bare foot in imitation of a ghost hand, the kind, trustful face of Empress Eugenie. On the promenade near the casino, an elderly flower girl, with carbon eyebrows and a painted smile, nimbly slipped the plump torus of a carnation into the buttonhole of an intercepted stroller whose left jowl accentuated its royal fold as he glanced down sideways at the coy insertion of the flower. The rich-hued oak eggers questing amid the brush were quite unlike ours, which did not breed on oak anyway, and here the speckled woods haunted not woods but hedges and had tawny, not pale yellowish spots. Cleopatra, a tropical-looking lemon-and-orange brimstone, languorously flopping about in gardens, had been a sensation in 1907 and was still a pleasure to net. Along the back line of the plage, various seaside chairs and stools supported the parents of straw-hatted children who were playing in front on the sand. I could be seen on my knees trying to set a found comb aflame by means of a magnifying glass. Men sported white trousers that to the eye of today would look as if they had comically shrunk in the washing. Ladies wore, that particular season, light coats with silk-faced lapels, hats with big crowns and wide brims, dense embroidered white veils, frill-fronted blouses, frills at their wrists, frills on their parasols. The breeze salted one's lips. At a tremendous pace, a stray clouded yellow came dashing across the palpitating plage. Additional movement and sound were provided by vendors hawking cacahuète, sugared violets, pistachio ice cream of a heavenly green, cashew pellets, and huge convex pieces of dry, gritty, wafer-like stuff that came from a red barrel. With a distinctness that no later superpositions have dimmed, I see that waffle man stomp along through deep, mealy sand with the heavy cask on his bent back. When called, he would sling it off his shoulder by a twist of its strap, bang it down on the sand in a Tower of Pisa position, wipe his face with his sleeve, and proceed to manipulate a kind of arrow and dial arrangement with numbers on the lid of the cask. The arrow rasped and whirred around. Luck was supposed to fix the size of a sou's worth of wafer. The bigger the piece, the more I was sorry for him. The process of bathing took place on another part of the beach. Professional bathers, burly Basques in black bathing suits, were there to help ladies and children enjoy the terrors of the surf. Such a bagneur would place the client with his back to the incoming wave and hold him by the hand as the rising, rotating mass of foamy green water violently descended from behind, knocking one off one's feet with a mighty wallop. After a dozen of these tumbles, the bagneur, glistening like a seal, would lead his panting, shivering, moistly snuffling charge landward to the flat foreshore, where an unforgettable old woman with gray hairs on her chin promptly chose a bathing robe from several hanging on a clothesline. In the security of a little cabin, one would be helped by yet another attendant to peel off one's soggy, sand-heavy bathing suit. It would plop onto the boards, and still shivering, one would step out of it and trample on its bluish, diffuse stripes. The cabin smelled of pine. The attendant, a hunchback with beaming wrinkles, brought a basin of steaming hot water in which one immersed one's feet. From him I learned, and have preserved ever since in a glass cell of my memory, that butterfly, in the Basque language, is misericoletia, or at least it sounded so. Among the seven words I have found in dictionaries, the closest approach is micheletia. 3. On the browner and wetter part of the plage, that part which at low tide yielded the best mud for castles, I found myself digging one day side by side with a little French girl called Colette. She would be 10 in November. I had been 10 in April. Attention was drawn to a jagged bit of violet mussel shell upon which she had stepped with the bare sole of her narrow, long-toed foot. No, I was not English. Her greenish eyes seemed flecked with the overflow of the freckles that covered her sharp-featured face. She wore what might now be termed a play suit, consisting of a blue jersey with rolled-up sleeves and blue-knitted shorts. I had taken her at first for a boy, and then had been puzzled by the bracelet on her thin wrist and the corkscrew brown curls dangling from under her sailor cap. She spoke in bird-like bursts of rapid twitter, mixing governess English and Parisian French. 2 years before, on the same plage, I had been much attached to Zina, the lovely sun-tanned, bad-tempered little daughter of a Serbian naturopath. She had, I remember, absurdly, for she and I were only 8 at the time, a grande beauté on her apricot skin just below the heart, and there was a horrible collection of chamber pots, full and half-full, and one with surface bubbles on the floor of the hall in her family's boarding-house lodgings, which I visited early one morning to be given by her as she was being dressed, a dead hummingbird moth found by the cat. But when I met Colette, I knew at once that this was the real thing. Colette seemed to me so much stranger than all my other chance playmates at Biarritz. I somehow acquired the feeling that she was less happy than I, less loved. A bruise on her delicate downy forearm gave rise to awful conjectures. "He pinches as bad as my mummy," she said, speaking of a crab. I evolved various schemes to save her from her parents, who were des bourgeois de Paris, as I heard somebody tell my mother with a slight shrug. I interpreted the disdain in my own fashion, as I knew that those people had come all the way from Paris in their blue and yellow limousine, a fashionable adventure in those days, but had drably sent Colette with her dog and governess by an ordinary coach train. The dog was a female fox terrier with bells on her collar and a most waggly behind. From sheer exuberance, she would lap up salt water out of Colette's toy pail. I remember the sail, the sunset, and the lighthouse pictured on that pail, but I cannot recall the dog's name, and this bothers me. During the 2 months of our stay at Biarritz, my passion for Colette all but surpassed my passion for Cleopatra. Since my parents were not keen to meet hers, I saw her only on the beach. But I thought of her constantly. If I noticed she had been crying, I felt a surge of helpless anguish that brought tears to my own eyes. I could not destroy the mosquitoes that had left their bites on her frail neck, but I could, and did, have a successful fistfight with a red-haired boy who had been rude to her. She used to give me warm handfuls of hard candy. One day, as we were bending together over a starfish, and Colette's ringlets were tickling my ear, she suddenly turned toward me and kissed me on the cheek. So great was my emotion that all I could think of saying was, "You little monkey!" I had a gold coin that I assumed would pay for our elopement. Where did I want to take her? Spain? America? The mountains above Pau? Là-bas, là-bas, dans la montagne, as I had heard Carmen sing at the opera. One strange night, I lay awake, listening to the recurrent thud of the ocean and planning our flight. The ocean seemed to rise and grope in the darkness, and then heavily fall on its face. Of our actual getaway, I have little to report. My memory retains a glimpse of her obediently putting on rope-soled canvas shoes on the lee side of a flapping tent, while I stuffed a folding butterfly net into a brown paper bag. The next glimpse is of our evading pursuit by entering a pitch-dark cinema near the casino, which of course was absolutely out of bounds. There we sat, holding hands across the dog, which now and then gently jingled in Colette's lap, and were shown a jerky, drizzly, but highly exciting bullfight at San Sebastian. My final glimpse is of myself being led along the promenade by Lindarovsky. His long legs move with a kind of ominous briskness, and I can see the muscles of his grimly set jaw working under the tight skin. My bespectacled brother, aged 9, whom he happens to hold with his other hand, keeps trotting out forward to peer at me with awed curiosity, like a little owl. Among the trivial souvenirs acquired at Biarritz before leaving, my favorite was not the small bull of black stone, and not the sonorous seashell, but something which now seems almost symbolic. A meerschaum penholder, with a tiny peephole of crystal in its ornamental part. One held it quite close to one's eye, screwing up the other, and when one had got rid of the shimmer of one's own lashes, a miraculous photographic view of the bay and of the line of cliffs ending in a lighthouse could be seen inside. And now a delightful thing happens. The process of recreating that penholder and the microcosm in its islet stimulates my memory to a last effort. I try again to recall the name of Colette's dog, and triumphantly, along those remote beaches over the glossy evening sands of the past, where each footprint slowly fills up with sunset water, here it comes, echoing and vibrating, Floss, Floss, Floss! Colette was back in Paris by the time we stopped there for a day before continuing our homeward journey. And there in a fawn park under a cold blue sky, I saw her, by arrangement between our mentors, I believe, for the last time. She carried a hoop and a short stick to drive it with, and everything about her was extremely proper and stylish in an autumnal Parisian tenue de ville pour fillette way. She took from her governess and slipped into my brother's hand a farewell present, a box of sugar-coated almonds meant, I knew, solely for me, and instantly she was off, tap-tapping her glinting hoop through light and shade, around and around a fountain choked with dead leaves near which I stood. The leaves mingle in my memory with the leather of her shoes and gloves, and there was, I remember, some detail in her attire, perhaps a ribbon on her Scottish cap or the pattern of her stockings, that reminded me then of the rainbow spiral in a glass marble. I still seemed to be holding that wisp of iridescence, not knowing exactly where to fit it, while she runs with her hoop ever faster around me and finally dissolves among the slender shadows cast on the graveled path by the interlaced arches of its low, looped fence. Chapter 8 1 I am going to show a few slides. But first let me indicate the where and the when of the matter. My brother and I were born in St. Petersburg, the capital of Imperial Russia, he in the middle of March 1900, and I 11 months earlier. The English and French governesses we had in our childhood were eventually assisted and finally superseded by Russian-speaking tutors, most of them graduate students at the capital's university. This tutorial era started about 1906 and lasted for almost a full decade, overlapping from 1911 on our high school years. Each tutor, in turn, dwelt with us at our St. Petersburg house during the winter, and the rest of the time either at our country estate, 50 miles from the city, or at the foreign resorts we often visited in the fall. 3 years was the maximum it took me. I was better at such things than my brother, to wear out any one of those hardy young men. In choosing our tutors, my father seemed to have hit upon the ingenious idea of engaging each time a representative of another class or race, so as to expose us to all the winds that swept over the Russian Empire. I doubt that it was a completely deliberate scheme on his part, but in looking back, I find the pattern curiously clear, and the images of those tutors appear within memory's luminous disk as so many magic lantern projections. The admirable and unforgettable village schoolmaster who in the summer of 1905 taught us Russian spelling used to come for only a few hours a day, and thus does not really belong to the present series. He helps, however, to join its beginning and its end, since my final recollection of him refers to the Easter vacation in 1915, which my brother and I spent with my father and one Volgin, the last and worst tutor, skiing in the snow-smothered country around our estate under an intense, almost violet sky. Our old friend invited us to his lodgings in the icicle-eaved school building for what he called a snack. Actually, it was a complex and lovingly planned meal. I can still see his beaming face and the beautifully simulated delight with which my father welcomed a dish, hare roasted in sour cream, that I knew he happened to detest. The room was overheated. My thawing ski boots were not as waterproof as they were supposed to be. My eyes, still smarting from the dazzling snows, kept trying to decipher on the near wall a so-called typographical portrait of Tolstoy. Like the tale of the mouse on a certain page in Alice in Wonderland, it was wholly composed of printed matter. A complete Tolstoy story, Master and Man, had gone to make its author's bearded face, which, incidentally, our host's features somewhat resembled. We were just on the point of attacking the unfortunate hare, when the door flew open, and Christopher, a blue-nosed footman in a woman's woolen kerchief, ushered in sideways, with an idiotic smile, a huge luncheon basket packed with viands and wines that my tactless grandmother, who was wintering at Batovo, had thought necessary to send us in case the schoolmaster's fare proved insufficient. Before our host had time to feel hurt, my father sent the untouched hamper back, with a brief note that probably puzzled the well-meaning old lady, as most of his actions puzzled her. In a flowing silk gown and net mitts, a period piece rather than a live person, she spent most of her life on a couch, fanning herself with an ivory fan. A box of boule de gomme, or a glass of almond milk, were always within her reach, as well as a hand mirror, for she used to repowder her face with a large pink puff every hour or so, the little mole on her cheekbone showing through all that flour like a currant. Notwithstanding the languid aspects of her usual day, she remained an extraordinarily hardy woman, and made a point of sleeping near a wide-open window all year round. One morning, after a night-long blizzard, her maid found her lying under a layer of sparkling snow which had swept over her bed and her, without infringing upon the healthy glow of her sleep. If she loved anybody, it was only her youngest daughter, Nadezhda von Liarliarsky, for whose sake she suddenly sold Batovo in 1916, a deal which benefited no one at that dusking tide of imperial history. She complained to all our relatives about the dark forces that had seduced her gifted son into scorning the kind of brilliant career in the Tsar's service his forefathers had pursued. What she found especially hard to understand was that my father, who she knew thoroughly appreciated all the pleasures of great wealth, could jeopardize its enjoyment by becoming a liberal, thus helping to bring on a revolution that would in the long run, as she correctly foresaw, leave him a pauper. 2. Our spelling master was a carpenter's son. In the magic lantern sequence that follows, my first slide shows a young man called Ordo, the enlightened son of a Greek Catholic deacon. On walks with my brother and me in the cool summer of 1907, he wore a Byronic black cloak with a silver S-shaped clasp. In the deep Batovo woods, at a spot near a brook where the ghost of a hanged man was said to appear, Ordo would give a rather profane and foolish performance for which my brother and I clamored every time we passed there. Bending his head and flapping his cloak in weird vampiric fashion, he would slowly cavort around a lugubrious aspen. One wet morning during that ritual, he dropped his cigarette case, and while helping to look for it, I discovered two freshly emerged specimens of the Amur hawk moth, rare in our region, lovely, velvety, purplish-gray creatures, in tranquil copulation, clinging with chinchilla-coated legs to the grass at the foot of the tree. In the fall of that same year, Ordo accompanied us to Biarritz, and a few weeks later abruptly departed, leaving a present we had given him, a Gillette safety razor on his pillow with a pinned note. It seldom happens that I do not quite know whether a recollection is my own or has come to me second-hand. But in this case I do waver, especially because much later my mother, in her reminiscent moods, used to refer with amusement to the flame she had unknowingly kindled. I seem to remember a door ajar into a drawing room, and there in the middle of the floor, Ordo, our Ordo, crouching on his knees and wringing his hands in front of my young, beautiful, and dumbfounded mother. The fact that I seem to see out of the corner of my mind's eye the undulations of a romantic cloak around Ordo's heaving shoulders suggests my having transferred something of the earlier forest dance to that blurred room in our Biarritz apartment, under the windows of which, in a roped-off section of the square, a huge custard-colored balloon was being inflated by Sigismond Lejoyeux, a local aeronaut. Next came a Ukrainian, an exuberant mathematician with a dark mustache and a sparkling smile. He spent part of the winter of 1907 to 1908 with us. He, too, had his accomplishments, among which a vanishing coin trick was particularly fetching. A coin placed on a sheet of paper is covered with a tumbler and forthwith disappears. Take an ordinary drinking glass. Paste neatly over its mouth a round piece of paper. The paper should be ruled or otherwise patterned. This will enhance the illusion. Place upon a similarly ruled sheet a small coin. A silver 20-kopeck piece will do. Briskly slip the tumbler over the coin, taking care to have both sets of rules or patterns tally. Coincidence of pattern is one of the wonders of nature. The wonders of nature were beginning to impress me at that early age. On one of his Sundays off, the poor conjurer collapsed in the street and was shoved by the police into a cold cell with a dozen drunks. Actually, he suffered from a heart condition, of which he died a few years later. The next picture looks as if it had come on the screen upside down. It shows our third tutor standing on his head. He was a large, formidably athletic Let, who walked on his hands, lifted enormous weights, juggled with dumbbells, and in a trice could fill a large room with a garrison's worth of sweat reek. When he deemed it fit to punish me for some slight misdemeanor, I remember, for instance, letting a child's marble fall from an upper landing upon his attractive, hard-looking head as he walked downstairs, he would adopt the remarkable pedagogic measure of suggesting that he and I put on boxing gloves for a bit of sparring. He would then punch me in the face with stinging accuracy. Although I preferred this to the hand-cramping pensums Mademoiselle would think up, such as making me copy out 200 times the proverb, qui aime bien, châtie bien, I did not miss the good man when he left after a stormy month's stay. Then came a Pole. He was a handsome medical student, with liquid brown eyes and sleek hair, who looked rather like the French actor Max Linder, a popular movie comedian. Max lasted from 1908 to 1910, and won my admiration on a winter day in St. Petersburg, when a sudden commotion interrupted our usual morning walk. Whip-brandishing Cossacks, with fierce, imbecile faces, were urging their prancing and snorting ponies against an excited crowd. Lots of caps and at least three galoshes lay black on the snow. For a moment it seemed as if one of the Cossacks was heading our way, and I saw Max half draw from an inside pocket a small automatic with which I forthwith fell in love. But unfortunately the turmoil receded. Once or twice he took us to see his brother, an emaciated Roman Catholic priest of great distinction, whose pale hands absent-mindedly hovered over our little Greek Catholic heads, while Max and he discussed political or family matters in a stream of sibilant Polish. I visualize my father on a summer day in the country, vying with Max in marksmanship, riddling with pistol bullets a rusty no-hunting sign in our woods. He was, this pleasant Max, a vigorous chap, and therefore I used to be taken aback when he complained of migraine and languidly refused to join me in kicking a football around or going for a dip in the river. I know now that he was having an affair that summer with a married woman whose property lay a dozen miles away. At odd moments during the day, he would sneak off to the kennels in order to feed and cajole our chained watchdogs. They were set loose at 11 p.m. to rove around the house, and he had to confront them in the dead of night when he slipped out and made for the shrubbery, where a bicycle with all accessories, thumb bell, pump, tool case of brown leather, and even trouser clips, had been secretly prepared for him by an ally, my father's Polish valet. Holy dirt roads and humpy forest trails would take impatient Max to the remote trysting place, which was a hunting lodge, in the grand tradition of elegant adultery. The chill mists of dawn and four Great Danes with short memories would see him cycling back, and at 8 a.m. a new day would begin. I wonder if it was not with a certain relief that in the autumn of that year, 1909, Max left the scene of his nightly exploits to accompany us on our second trip to Biarritz. Piously, penitently, he took a couple of days off to visit Lourdes in the company of the pretty and fast Irish girl who was the governess of Colette, my favorite playmate on the plage. Max abandoned us the next year for a job in the X-ray department of a St. Petersburg hospital, and later on, between the two world wars, became, I understand, something of a medical celebrity in Poland. After the Catholic came the Protestant, a Lutheran of Jewish extraction. He will have to figure here under the name of Lenski. My brother and I went with him late in 1910 to Germany, and after we came back in January of the following year and began going to school in St. Petersburg, Lenski stayed on for about 3 years to help us with our homework. It was during his reign that Mademoiselle, who had been with us since the winter of 1905, finally gave up her struggle against intruding Muscovites and returned to Lausanne. Lenski had been born in poverty, and liked to recall that between graduating from the gymnasium of his native town on the Black Sea and being admitted to the University of St. Petersburg, he had supported himself by ornamenting stones from the shingled shore with bright seascapes and selling them as paperweights. He had an oval pink face, short-lashed, curiously naked eyes behind a rimless pince-nez, and a pale blue shaven head. We discovered at once three things about him. He was an excellent teacher, he lacked all sense of humor, and in contrast to our previous tutors, he was someone we needed to defend. The security he felt as long as our parents were around might be shattered at any time in their absence by some sally on the part of our aunts. For them, my father's fierce writings against pogroms and other governmental practices were but the whims of a wayward nobleman, and I often overheard them discussing with horror Lenski's origins and my father's insane experiments. After such an occasion, I would be dreadfully rude to them, and then burst into hot tears in the seclusion of a water closet. Not that I particularly liked Lenski. There was something irritating about his dry voice, his excessive neatness, the way he had of constantly wiping his glasses with a special cloth or paring his nails with a special gadget, his pedantically correct speech, and perhaps most of all, his fantastic morning custom of marching, seemingly straight out of bed but already shod and trousered, with red braces hanging behind and a strange net-like vest enveloping his plump, hairy torso, to the nearest faucet, and limiting there his ablutions to a thorough sousing of his pink face, blue skull, and fat neck, followed by some lusty Russian nose-blowing, after which he marched, with the same purposeful steps, but now dripping and purblind, back to his bedroom, where he kept in a secret place three sacrosanct towels. Incidentally, he was so brezgliv, in the Russian untranslatable sense, that he would wash his hands after touching banknotes or banisters. He complained to my mother that Sergei and I were little foreigners, freaks, fops, snobby, pathologically indifferent, as he put it, to Goncharov, Grigorovich, Korolenko, Stanukovich, Mamin Sibiriak, and other stupefying bores, comparable to American regional writers, whose works, according to him, enthralled normal boys. To my obscure annoyance, he advised my parents to have their two boys, the three younger children were beyond his jurisdiction, lead a more democratic form of life, which meant, for example, switching in Berlin from the Adlon Hotel to a vast apartment in a gloomy pension in a lifeless lane, and replacing pile-carpeted International Express trains by the filthy floors and stale cigar smoke of swaying and pitching Schnellzugs. In foreign towns, as well as in St. Petersburg, he would freeze before shops to marvel at wares that left us completely indifferent. He was about to be married, had nothing but his salary, and was planning his future household with the utmost cunning and care. Now and then, rash impulses interfered with his budget. Noticing one day a bedraggled hag who was gloating over a crimson-plumed hat on display at a milliner's, he bought it for her, and had quite a time getting rid of the woman. In his own acquisitions, he aimed at great circumspection. My brother and I patiently listened to his detailed daydreams as he analyzed every corner of the cozy yet frugal apartment he mentally prepared for his wife and himself. Sometimes his fancy would soar. Once it settled on an expensive ceiling lamp at Alexander's, a St. Petersburg shop that featured rather painful bourgeois bric-a-brac. Not wishing the store to suspect what object he coveted, Lenski said he would take us to see it only if we swore to use self-control and not attract unnecessary attention by direct contemplation. With all kinds of precautions, he brought us under a dreadful bronze octopus, and his only indication that this was the longed-for article was a purring sigh. He used the same care, tiptoeing and whispering in order not to wake the monster of fate, which he seemed to think bore him a personal grudge, when introducing us to his fiancée, a small, graceful young lady with scared gazelle eyes and the scent of fresh violets clinging to her black veil. We met her, I remember, near a pharmacy at the corner of Potsdamer Straße and Privatstraße, a lane full of dead leaves where our pension was, and he urged us to keep his bride's presence in Berlin secret from our parents, and the mechanical mannequin in the pharmacy window was going through the motions of shaving, and tram cars screeched by, and it was beginning to snow. 3. We are now ready to tackle the main theme of this chapter. Sometime during the following winter, Lenski conceived the awful idea of showing, on alternate Sundays, educational magic lantern projections at our St. Petersburg home. By their means, he proposed to illustrate, abundantly, as he said with a smack of his thin lips, instructive readings before a group that he fondly believed would consist of entranced boys and girls sharing in a memorable experience. Besides adding to our store of information, it might, he thought, help make my brother and me into good little mixers. Using us as a core, he accumulated around this sullen center several layers of recruits, such coeval cousins of ours as happened to be at hand, various youngsters we met every winter at more or less tedious parties, some of our schoolmates, unusually quiet they were, but alas, registered every trifle, and the children of the servants. Having been given a completely free hand by my gentle and optimistic mother, he rented an elaborate apparatus and hired a dejected-looking university student to man it. As I see it now, warm-hearted Lenski was, among other things, trying to help an impecunious comrade. Never shall I forget that first reading. Lenski had selected a narrative poem by Lermontov, dealing with the adventures of a young monk who left his Caucasian retreat to roam among the mountains. As usual with Lermontov, the poem combined pedestrian statements with marvelous melting Fata Morgana effects. It was of goodly length, and its 750 rather monotonous lines were generously spread by Lenski over a mere 4 slides, a fifth I had clumsily broken just before the performance. Fire hazard considerations had led one to select for the show an obsolete nursery in a corner of which stood a columnar water heater, painted a bronzy brown, and a web-footed bath which for the occasion had been chastely sheeted. The close-drawn window curtains prevented one from seeing the yard below, the stacks of birch logs, and the yellow walls of the gloomy annex containing the stables, part of which had been converted into a 2-car garage. Despite the ejection of an ancient wardrobe and a couple of trunks, this depressing back room, with the magic lantern installed at one end, and transverse rows of chairs, hassocks, and settees arranged for a score of spectators, including Lenski's fiancée and 3 or 4 governesses, not counting our own Mademoiselle and Miss Greenwood, looked jammed and felt stuffy. On my left, one of my most fidgety girl cousins, a nebulous little blonde of 11 or so with long Alice in Wonderland hair and a shell-pink complexion, sat so close to me that I felt the slender bone of her hip move against mine every time she shifted in her seat, fingering her locket, or passing the back of her hand between her perfumed hair and the nape of her neck, or knocking her knees together under the rustly silk of her yellow slip, which shone through the lace of her frock. On my right I had the son of my father's Polish valet, an absolutely motionless boy in a sailor suit. He bore a striking resemblance to the Tsarevich, and by a still more striking coincidence, suffered from the same tragic disease, hemophilia, so several times a year a court carriage would bring a famous physician to our house, and wait in the slow slanting snow, and if one chose the largest of those grayish flakes, and kept one's eye upon it as it came down, past the aureole casement through which one peered, one could make out its rather coarse, irregular shape, and also its oscillation in flight, making one feel dull and dizzy, dizzy and dull. The lights went out. Lenski launched upon the opening lines. "The time, not many years ago, the place, a point where meet and flow in sisterly embrace the fair Aragva and Kura, right there a monastery stood." The monastery, with its two rivers, dutifully appeared and stayed on in a lurid trance, if only one swift could have swept over it, for about 200 lines, when it was replaced by a Georgian maiden of sorts carrying a pitcher. When the operator withdrew a slide, the picture was whisked off the screen with a peculiar flick, magnification affecting not only the scene displayed, but also the speed of its removal. Otherwise, there was little magic. We were shown conventional peaks instead of Lermontov's romantic mountains, which rose in the glory of the dawn like smoking altars, and while the young monk was telling a fellow recluse of his struggle with a leopard, "Oh, I was awesome to behold, myself a leopard, wild and bold, his flaming rage, his yells were mine," a subdued caterwauling sounded behind me. It might have come from young Zhevuski, with whom I used to attend dancing classes, or Alec Nitti, who was to win some renown a year or two later for poltergeist phenomena, or one of my cousins. Gradually, as Lenski's reedy voice went on and on, I became aware that with a few exceptions, such as perhaps Samuel Rosoff, a sensitive schoolmate of mine, the audience was secretly scoffing at the performance, and that afterward I would have to cope with various insulting remarks. I felt a quiver of acute pity for Lenski, for the meek folds of the back of his shaven head, for his pluck, for the nervous movements of his pointer, over which, in cold, kittenish paw play, the colors would sometimes slip when he brought it too close to the screen. Toward the end, the monotony of the proceedings became quite unbearable. The flustered operator could not find the fourth slide, having got it mixed up with the used ones, and while Lenski patiently waited in the dark, some of the spectators started to project the black shadows of their raised hands upon the frightened white screen, and presently, one ribald and agile boy, could it be I, after all, the hide of my Jekyll, managed to silhouette his foot, which of course started some boisterous competition. When at last the slide was found and flashed onto the screen, I was reminded of a journey in my early childhood through the long, dark St. Gothard tunnel, which our train entered during a thunderstorm, but it was all over when we emerged, and then blue, green, and orange, wonder-struck with its own loveliness and luck, across a crag a rainbow fell, and captured there a poised gazelle. I should add that during this and the following still more crowded, still more awful Sunday afternoon sessions, I was haunted by the reverberations of certain family tales I had heard. In the early 80s, my maternal grandfather, Ivan Rukavishnikov, not finding for his sons any private school to his liking, had created an academy of his own by hiring a dozen of the finest professors available and assembling a score of boys for several terms of free education in the halls of his St. Petersburg house, a number 10 Admiralty Quay. The venture was not a success. Those friends of his whose sons he wanted to consort with his own were not always compliant, and of the boys he did get, many proved disappointing. I formed a singularly displeasing image of him, exploring schools for his obstinate purpose, his sad and strange eyes, so familiar to me from photographs, seeking out the best-looking boys among the best scholars. He is said to have actually paid needy parents in order to muster companions for his two sons. Little as our tutor's naive lantern slide shows had to do with Rukavishnikovian extravaganzas, my mental association of the two enterprises did not help me to put up with Lenski's making a fool and a bore of himself, so I was happy when after three more performances, The Bronze Horseman by Pushkin, Don Quixote, and Africa, the Land of Marvels, My mother acceded to my frantic supplications, and the whole business was dropped. Now that I come to think of it, how tawdry and tumid they looked, those jelly-like pictures projected upon the damp linen screen. Moisture was supposed to make them blossom more richly. But on the other hand, what loveliness the glass slides as such revealed when simply held between finger and thumb and raised to the light. Translucent miniatures, pocket wonderlands, neat little worlds of hushed, luminous hues. In later years, I rediscovered the same precise and silent beauty at the radiant bottom of a microscope's magic shaft. In the glass of the slide, meant for projection, a landscape was reduced, and this fired one's fancy. Under the microscope, an insect's organ was magnified for cool study. There is, it would seem, in the dimensional scale of the world, a kind of delicate meeting place between imagination and knowledge, a point arrived at by diminishing large things and enlarging small ones that is intrinsically artistic. 4. Considering how versatile Lenski appeared to be, how thoroughly he could explain anything related to our school studies, his constant tribulations at the university came as something of a surprise. Their cause, it transpired eventually, was his complete lack of aptitude for the financial and political problems he so stubbornly tackled. I recall the jitters he was in when he had to take one of his most important final examinations. I was as worried as he, and just before the pending event, could not resist eavesdropping at the door of the room where my father, upon Lenski's urgent request, gave him a private rehearsal by testing his knowledge of Charles Gide's Principles of Political Economy. Thumbing the leaves of the book, my father might inquire, for instance, "What is the cause of value?" or "What are the differences between the banknote and paper money?" And Lenski would eagerly clear his throat, and then remain perfectly silent, as if he had expired. After a while he ceased to produce even that brisk little cough of his, and the intervals of silence were punctuated only by my father's drumming upon the table, except that once, in a spurt of rapid and hopeful remonstration, the sufferer suddenly exclaimed, "This question is not in the book, sir!" But it was. Finally my father sighed, closed the textbook gently but audibly, and remarked, "Golubchik, my dear fellow, you cannot but fail. You simply don't know a thing." "I disagree with you there," retorted Lenski, not without dignity. Sitting as stiffly as if he were stuffed, he was driven in our car to the university, remained there till dusk, came back in a sleigh, in a heap, in a snowstorm, and in silent despair went up to his room. Toward the end of his stay with us, he married and went away on a honeymoon to the Caucasus, to Lermontov's mountains, and then came back to us for another winter. During his absence in the summer of 1913, a Swiss tutor, Monsieur Noyer, took over. He was a sturdily built man, with a bristly mustache, and he read us Rostand's Cyrano de Bergerac, mouthing every line most lusciously and changing his voice from flute to bassoon according to the characters he mimed. At tennis, when he was a server, he would firmly stand on the back line with his thick legs in wrinkled nankeens wide apart, and would abruptly bend them at the knees as he gave the ball a tremendous but singularly inefficient whack. When Lenski, in the spring of 1914, left us for good, we had a young man from a Volgan province. He was a charming fellow of gentle birth, a fair tennis player, an excellent horseman. On such accomplishments he was greatly relieved to rely, since at that late date neither my brother nor I needed much the educational help that an optimistic patron of his had promised my parents the wretch could give us. In the course of our very first colloquy, he casually informed me that Dickens had written Uncle Tom's Cabin, which led to a pounce bet on my part, winning me his knuckle-duster. After that, he was careful not to refer to any literary character or subject in my presence. He was very poor, and a strange, dusty and etherish, not altogether unpleasant smell came from his faded university uniform. He had beautiful manners, a sweet temper, an unforgettable handwriting, all thorns and bristles, the like of which I have seen only in the letters from madmen that, alas, I sometimes received since the year of grace 1958, and an unlimited fund of obscene stories, which he fed me sub rosa in a dreamy, velvety voice, without using one gross expression, about his pals and pool, and also about various relations of ours, one of whom, a fashionable lady almost twice his age, he soon married, only to get rid of her, during his subsequent career in Lenin's administration, by bundling her off to a labor camp where she perished. The more I think of that man, the more I believe that he was completely insane. I did not quite lose track of Lenski. On a loan from his father,